Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
This audio presentation contains graphic details of death, violence, and controversial subject matter. Listener discretion is strongly advised. From Dead Souls Media, this is What Happened to Johnny, Part 2. I'm Jamie Black, a researcher and psychologist, and I'll be your host for tonight. This episode is part 2 of our two-part series. We previously spoke about the disappearance of Iowa paperboy Johnny Gosch in September of 1982. We spoke about the search for Johnny and what challenges the family faced while looking for their son. But we also explored how a number of other paperboys from the same area and around the same age also disappeared sporadically throughout the following decade. How the police stated that the cases were not related, but how unlikely that actually was. Things started to get strange in this case, and bizarre events began to develop. Well, in tonight's episode, we are going to dig into how the missing boys' cases eventually evolved into a far bigger situation and a conspiracy that blew up into a national scandal. Because, along with Eaton Patz and Adam Walsh, the name Johnny Gosch would change the face of America forever. It impacted not only parental trust and confidence in the society around them, but it changed police and public attention in regards to how missing children cases are treated. It also revealed some hidden secrets that those involved with would wish remained within the shadows. Another big one tonight, so let's get into it. Allegations and scandal. By October 1986, police received a videotaped confession by a man working for the Des Moines Register. He confessed to molesting paperboys who were employed by the Register newspaper. This provided the investigation with its first publicly named suspect. His name was Frank Sikora. As it transpires, Sikora was no stranger to Des Moines police. You see, back in 1974, Frank's brother was arrested for sodomizing a 10-year-old boy. The boy had spent the night at their home. And the reason the child was there? Well, he was going to help 37-year-old Frank with his paper route the next morning. I'll allow you a minute to draw your own thoughts together over that one. Samuel Soda, a private investigator and founder of SCARED, an acronym for Stolen Children Are Reported Daily, began investigating the Gosch case off of his own back. He wasn't hired by the Goshes or the Des Moines Police Department. It was Soda who conducted the videotaped interview with Frank Sikora, during which Frank admitted to fondling as many as 7 paper carriers during his time employed at the Des Moines Register. He did so under the pretense of hiring them to run papers from his car to each house. Frank would invite the boys to sleep over at his house the night before, where he would show the boys illicit material and inappropriately touch them. Frank was immediately fired from his job in the Register's circulation department, but police would announce that they had cleared Sikora as a suspect in the Gosch and Martin disappearances. The police based the dismissal on a single polygraph test, choosing instead to charge him for just 2 sexual assaults on boys aged 13 and 14. But these charges still earned Frank Sikora a 10-year prison sentence, although he would serve just 4 years before being paroled. Sikora moved to northwestern Iowa following his release from prison, where he remained until his death in 2020. As for Samuel Soda, the independent private investigator, well, remember that name? And we'll come back to him a bit later. Noreen and John Gosch Sr. were so unhappy with the police department's lack of interest in their son's case that they hired 2 private investigators. a retired New York police detective named Jim Rothstein, and a retired FBI agent named Ted Gunderson. They were both tasked with finding out what happened to Johnny and to bring him home. In 1990, the remains of a human skeleton were found on the outskirts of Des Moines. The remains were tested using early DNA profiling against records of Mark Allen, Johnny Gosch, and Eugene Martin. This was the first indicator that the police were considering murder in relation to the disappearance of the paperboys, rather than missing persons or runaways, though the authorities wouldn't publicly comment on this. Yet again, sadly, the families were left without answers when the skeleton was determined to be that of an adult female, possibly linked to serial killer Marvin Lee Irwin. Three paperboys taken in such a short period of time in the same area, while said not to be linked, was highly suspicious, and the public were feeling this too. But it wouldn't be long until someone tried to grab another newspaper carrier from the streets of Des Moines. On the morning of Thursday, July 10th, 1986, 15-year-old Jim Pollock was walking along 42nd Street in Ingersoll Park, just a few neighborhoods west of downtown Des Moines. Pollock was delivering, you guessed it, the Des Moines Register newspaper at the time. A man ran across the street from behind Pollock and grabbed him, pulling his arms behind him. Pollock managed to struggle free by kicking his would-be abductor in the legs and sprinting the half mile to his home on 40th Street. Pollock immediately informed his parents, who contacted the police straight away. Even though the man who had tried to snatch Pollock had covered his face with a camo-coloured rain poncho, Pollock told police that the man was very clearly muscular, based on how he was able to grab him. The man remained silent throughout the entirety of the attack, however. Jim Pollock would also tell the police that roughly 6 weeks prior, he had been chased home by a man while he was again delivering newspapers. Pollock wasn't sure if it was the same man, as both had covered their faces and remained silent during the incidents. The police in Des Moines purposefully kept this incident hushed up as to not panic the local population. But it was clear to all who knew that there were obvious similarities to the previous three abductions. Jim Pollock was just 5 miles directly south from where Johnny Gosch went missing. Coincidence? Well, I'm not done just yet. In August that same year, yet another paperboy would disappear. 16-year-old Jason Rogers had come to town for the Iowa State Fair in August of 1986. He was accompanied by a group of his friends. During a particularly hot and sunny Saturday afternoon on the 16th of the month, he seemingly vanished. A massive police and civilian search was launched as everyone feared the worst. The police knew they couldn't continue to cover these abductions up. But then, 4 days later, Jason phoned home and spoke to his parents, Donald and Linda. It transpired that Rogers had planned his own disappearance all along, because he was tired of being treated like a child, he said. He ensured that he went to the fair with friends, was spotted and chatted briefly to a teacher of his, and then snuck off, knowing that a disappearance from a crowded fair would be hard to trace. He purchased a $129 one-way ticket to Santa Barbara in California, but he phoned home as he ran out of money. Following all of the commotion that this case kicked up, things went silent again for around 2 years, until a white van would begin terrorizing paperboys in Des Moines once again. The latest incident would happen in September 1988, when an unnamed paperboy between the ages of 10 and 13 would be chased through Indianola, a small city about 15 miles south of Des Moines. Once again, police withheld the boy's identity to, quote-unquote, avoid a panic. But 6 weeks later, on Tuesday, November the 1st, in the western Des Moines suburb of Clive, a 10-year-old boy named Mike Fackler was delivering newspapers at around 5 a.m. along Northwest 82nd Street. The location was just north of the highway from where the Gosch family lived. Suddenly, a heavy-set man in a jogging suit jumped from a white van and began to run towards Fackler. Immediately, the boy dropped his paper bag and booked it, screaming and banging on the door of Bill and Jan Tiegler, who lived on the corner of 82nd and Alice Avenue. When the couple heard the screams, Bill slowly got out of bed and began putting his trousers on. But when the screams turned into frantic banging on his door, he dropped the trousers and ran to his door.
If you had heard how the boy sounded, then you wouldn't have hesitated either,
Bill Tiegler commented. Once Fackler had begun pounding on the Tiegler's front door, the man stopped pursuing the boy. Police established that his description of the man matched that of the one given by the boy in Indianola. Noreen Gosh urged authorities and the public to take these recent incidents seriously and believe that they were all linked. Fackler's own father gave an interview stating that he, quote, wasn't very concerned and believed it was just a man out enjoying scaring children, probably a prank. The boy was 10 years old, and it happened at 5 a.m., I'll remind you. Mike Fackler's father did add that he planned to accompany his son on the paper route for the foreseeable future, so he hadn't totally abandoned his son in complete ignorance. He finished the press interview by stating that if the man, or anyone else for that matter, tried it again, then he would, quote, break their kneecaps. Mike Fackler, following pressure from his father, would later pass comment to police that it was possible that the man was simply a regular jogger and he had overreacted. Interesting parenting from Pops. Then, the following year, another two abduction attempts occurred, forcing everyone, once again, to take note. But first, remember the arrest of Frank Sikora from earlier, who was charged with molesting several paperboys from the Des Moines Register? Well, there's more. Police filed six charges against Wilbur Julius Milhouse, aged 43, in relation to sexually abusing underage boys. In November 1986, Milhouse was arrested at his home at 2553 Mowry Street in the Chesterfield area of East Des Moines. The police had been investigating Milhouse for almost a year and suspected that he was involved in a child abuse ring. During Milhouse's arrest, police discovered the names and numbers of around 2,000 young boys in his possession. Milhouse was a Des Moines Register circulation manager and claimed that he kept the boys' details to aid in recruiting new paperboys. Noreen Gosh said that Milhouse's arrest may shed some light on the disappearance of her son. She had argued for some time that her son's abductor was an employee of the newspaper who had access to the news carrier's routes. For the record, this isn't her belief any longer, but we'll come to that later. However, Milhouse may not have been acting alone. According to ex-paperboys at the Register, who were suspicious of Milhouse and his associates at the time, he may have had an accomplice named Richard Joseph Wyand. In 1974, Milhouse and Wyand were suspiciously at a high school at 2 a.m., where they interrupted a burglary, allegedly, thus being witnesses for the police in this case. Milhouse started working at the Des Moines Register in 1978. Milhouse and Wyand are in addition to previously mentioned Frank Sikora, who also worked at the Des Moines Register at the time. All three men were known to be close friends. An ex-paperboy who came forward in 2016, although chose to remain anonymous, stated that Wilbur Milhouse was his circulation manager back in 1982. And there were several things that made him suspicious of Milhouse. Firstly, was him seeing Milhouse hanging around with a friend of his called, quote, Richard. This person had approached the paperboy a year earlier in his car and initially asked him for directions to 82nd Street. As the paperboy began to give the directions to the man, he cut him off and said, quote, look, get in the car, I just want to mess around with you. Is this the same Richard as Richard Wyand? We know him and Milhouse were close friends at the Register after all. Well, in addition to that, at a Christmas party which the Register threw for all the paper carriers one year, The paperboy said him and several of the other paperboys heard Milhouse say, quote, "Nothing would have happened to Johnny Gosh if he had just kept his damn mouth shut." The anonymous paperboy stated that he stopped working as a news carrier in 1983 after Milhouse kept randomly calling him at home and telling him that he had wealthy friends who would pay $100 a time to see him, quote, "drop his pants." Wyand was arrested in 2003 for engaging in lewd homosexual acts in a public park. Both Wyand and Milhouse have since died, Milhouse in 2015 and Wyand in 2021. Back in northern Indianola, an 11-year-old boy was delivering newspapers around 5:15 a.m. on the morning of Saturday, July 17, 1988, when he noticed a white van with a red vinyl top turn the wrong way down a one-way street to follow him along his paper route. It was then that the driver hopped out of the van and began to scream obscenities and said that he would stab the boy if he didn't get into his van. The man managed to catch the child and started dragging him back towards his van, but the boy managed to wriggle free of his sweatshirt and run away. The man didn't give chase, instead choosing to speed off. Police released a composite of that abductor, who is said to be in his 40s, with salt and pepper coloured hair, stood 6 feet too tall, and walked with a slight stoop. Following this incident, Iowa's Division of Criminal Investigation would finally make the move to join the case with Mike Fackler's abduction attempt and also publicly state, for the first time, that the latest abductions may be related to Johnny Gosch and Eugene Martin's cases too. Now, let's skip back to Samuel Soder. You'll recall that he was the independent private investigator who took it upon himself to investigate Johnny Gosch's disappearance and obtained the confession via videotaped interview from Frank Sikora. Well, Sam Soder is often cited as the prime suspect in many armchair and Reddit detectives' lists of people involved in the abduction of Johnny. Soder served two tours of Vietnam in the Marine Corps. He also worked as an army recruiter in New York State, ran an auto parts shop in Kansas City, and spent a brief time as a police officer in Des Moines. Soder was originally from Des Moines and moved back there permanently in 1979. It was in 1980 that he started his private investigation agency. Soder had been married 3 times and had 6 children. Noreen and John Gosch first met Sam Soder in June 1984. They were suspicious of him right away, given how he knew so much about their son's disappearance. But then Soder warned the Gosches about the upcoming abduction of another paperboy. He did so around a week before the disappearance of Eugene Martin. Whilst this is highly suspicious, nobody thought to raise an eyebrow at the time for some reason. Now, this is where things start to get seedy. In addition to having inside information from quote-unquote underworld contacts, Soder also, through using actual child abuse images, travelled throughout Iowa giving presentations and lectures about the dangers of child predator rings. He even delivered these lectures to law enforcement groups. This is partly why people think that he's so shady. Soder would conduct his presentations where he claimed he received and utilized his child abuse images from a police officer in Minnesota. This led to speculation that Soder had a possible connection to a child trafficking ring in Minnesota. State prosecutors knew Soder was showing these highly illegal photographs, which were felonies in themselves, but seemingly turned a blind eye. The first assistant attorney of Polk County, Ron Wheeler, who was later disgraced and convicted in 2012 of orchestrating a real estate fraud scheme alongside convicted child abuser Russell Eugene Blessman. Well, Wheeler took no action against Soder after conducting his speaking tour for more than a year. In fact, Soder claimed that Wheeler gave his blessing to show the material. Sam Soder's self-founded organization, Stolen Children Are Reported Daily, was eventually disbanded in 1985. And Soder tried his hand at politics. He lost his run for the city council when it was revealed that he had lied about winning 2 Purple Hearts in Vietnam. so does campaign manager at the time, was a man by the name of Keith Colwell, a dentist by trade. According to Colwell's daughter, Soda disclosed to him during his campaign that he was in the car when Johnny was kidnapped. Make of that what you will. Soda would work on the Zoning Commission and close the detective agency in 1991 after filing for bankruptcy. Soda would be arrested in 1993 for beating his 15-year-old stepson, where he was charged with child endangerment and served a week in the county jail. Soda allegedly had ties to organized crime, a history of sexual assault, and he publicly announced very circumstantial and questionable evidence in his so-called search for Johnny. A lot of Soda's evidence seemed to convince Noreen Gosh, however, who would fall down the rabbit hole of conspiracy over time, even though she had the Des Moines police track and monitor Soda initially. David Schurter is an author and satanic ritual abuse survivor. Throughout his childhood, he was subjected to horrible rites performed on him by his own parents and other satanic cult followers. According to Schurter, Sam Soda owned a bar in Omaha, Nebraska, where he and some of the staff would participate in child trafficking and prostitution. Fun fact, but entirely circumstantial, so take this information how you will, but Sam Soda had a private investigation office located at 5906 Southwest 9th Street. This is only a minute away from Eugene Martin's kidnapping site. And Soda also lived on Emma Avenue, which is the same exact street as Mark Allen. And it was the same street which Mark Allen also was last seen walking down. It is unlikely we will ever know the full truth about Sam Soda. He passed away in 2020. In another twist, in 1989, a young 20-something man was arrested for sexually assaulting a child. He made statements that would not only tie him forever with the Johnny Gosch case, but seemingly uncover a massive child predator ring operating across the United States. Paul Bonacci and the Franklin Credit Union. 120 miles to the west of Des Moines lies the city of Omaha, Nebraska. Sitting along a quiet side street not far from downtown sits the former Franklin Credit Union. Since it opened in 1970, Lawrence E. King Jr. served as the bank treasurer and manager of the credit union. This one-time opera singer had risen as a prominent member within his community and also within the Republican Party, serving on Ronald Reagan's re-election inauguration committee and even singing the national anthem at the Republican National GOP convention. This is him here.
Ladies and gentlemen, the chair now recognizes Lawrence King Jr., a member of the Nebraska delegation, for the singing of the national anthem.
Absolute voice of an angel. There was, however, like everything else in this story, a dark and murky side to Lawrence E. King Jr. Around 1978, some 8 years after the credit union was formed, the first signs of mismanagement at the union emerged. Just to explain, for those of you that are unaware, a credit union is a member-owned and supposedly non-profit cooperative financial organization. They commonly offer financial services much like those of commercial banks and building societies. Anyway, in the case of the Franklin Credit Union, which was located at the time at 1723 North 33rd Street in Omaha, accountants discovered unusual deposits and withdrawals. This was in addition to loans being improperly documented, another tracking oversight, shall we say. All of this was in addition to loans being improperly documented, another tracking oversights, which would amount to over $400,000 in unaccounted for funds. By the dawn of the 1980s, many had a growing suspicion that Lawrence King was living way beyond his means due to him effectively being a bank manager, yet owning mansions in Washington, D.C. and Nebraska, owning a private jet, and regularly throwing huge, lavish parties. things didn't seem to add up to many people. An anonymous letter was sent to the Omaha police in one specific instance of whistleblowing, and in another, a bank teller would go to the board of directors and ask for Lawrence King to be directly investigated. In both instances, however, little to nothing would come of the accusations and claims, and this was primarily due to King's political influence. It was not until 1987 when an investigation into the Franklin Credit Union actually began. And just 3 months later, revelations about King sexually abusing women began to be uncovered. In November of 1988, the FBI and IRS would conduct a raid on the credit union offices, and in the process discover almost $40 million had been embezzled from the community at large. It became one of the largest credit union failures in American history, and likely one that you've never heard of. Lawrence King Jr. and a number of his colleagues pled guilty to 40 felony counts of fraud. This earned King a 15-year prison sentence. But this is not the entirety of the story. There's more to the Franklin scandal. While the credit union was being raided by authorities, the Nebraska State Foster Care Review Board turned over a multitude of reports which it had investigated against a number of the wealthy and elite members of society at the time, and how they had been sexually abusing children within the foster care system. They trafficked the children to parties, which were thrown by, yep, Lawrence E. King Jr. At the forefront of all of these allegations was a 24-year-old man named Paul Bonacci. Bonacci had himself been arrested on 3 counts of sexually abusing a child in 1989. But while incarcerated, Bonacci alleged that Lawrence E. King and his partners would coerce poor and runaway children to attend these parties as the so-called entertainment. They would be auctioned off as sex slaves for the wealthy and political elite. Bonacci was a prison inmate at Lincoln Correctional Facility in Lincoln, Nebraska. In November 1991, he came forward with some information about the Johnny Gosch disappearance. He admitted that he himself was involved in the Johnny Gosch kidnapping team. To be clear, Bonacci was not looking for any fame, financial gain, or any leniency in regard to his own sentence. When Bonacci made his claims in late 1991, he had less than a year remaining of his prison sentence. So if anything, Bonacci risked having his prison sentence extended or being charged with more crimes. But what exactly made him come forward almost 10 years after Johnny's abduction? Well, by 1991, Bonacci was now an adult. He stated that he was himself the victim of a child prostitution ring in Omaha, Nebraska, which began when he was just 6 years old. Like many victims of childhood sexual abuse, Bonacci would end up becoming an offender himself. And he was thus arrested and convicted of sexually abusing 3 young boys. But was he actually telling the truth about his involvement in the Johnny Gosch case? Well, Paul Bonacci, while in prison, had been diagnosed with multiple personality disorder by prison psychiatrists. This was thought to have been caused as a result of the abuse that Bonacci suffered earlier on in life. I'll talk more about multiple personality disorder in a little bit. Firstly, after Bonacci had made his claims, he was interviewed by America's Most Wanted in March of 1992. I'll post a link to the full interview in the description of this episode. In the interview, you can hear how he engages different personalities while discussing his experiences. Bonacci was 15 years old when Johnny Gosch disappeared in 1982. He said that his involvement in the kidnapping consisted of the following. He was situated in the back of the car that Johnny had been pulled into that warm September morning. He was tasked with holding Johnny down and placing a rag soaked in chloroform over his face to render him unconscious. A man named Tony was responsible for grabbing Johnny and forcing him into the car. After the abduction was over and Johnny awoke, Bonacci told him that if he did what he was told, then Johnny wouldn't be harmed. Bonacci went on that Emilio was the name of the mastermind behind the abduction plot. It was this Emilio who wanted, quote, clean kids that weren't involved in prostitution or drugs. Emilio wanted children that were well-raised and family-orientated because he liked to, quote, hurt people, innocent people. Emilio sounds like a right charmer. This is Paul Bonacci speaking on February the 6th, 1993.
At the beginning of the party, he had a lot of young guys stuff that were servers. We'd sometimes serve stuff, sometimes we'd be up in the background, we'd be walking around the party and stuff. Nothing was to take place then. After the party was over, the ones that were involved with him, or the ones that he was trying to get political favors from, that won whatever they wanted, they would stay or they'd come in after the party was over, or the next day. See, so at the party, nothing even abnormal. I mean, if somebody was in there and stuff, they'd see no abnormal activities going on.
Various state and federal agencies would dig into Bonacci's claims, including the FBI and Nebraska State Patrol. By this time, further ex-abused children, now adults, came forward to also claim that they were trafficked and abused at elite parties thrown by Lawrence King. Those individuals being namely Alicia Owen, Troy Bonner, and Danny King. Some even going so far as to say that they had been forced to take part in satanic rituals, brainwashing, and CIA arms deals. These claims seemed extremely sensational. So I'll drop two things in here. First, when Bonacci and the other witnesses came forward with their alleged accounts of abduction, trafficking, satanic ritual abuse, and political elite involvement, it was the height of the satanic panic in the United States. That's not me saying it's untrue, just an observation and worth being aware of while you gather your own thoughts and feelings regarding all of this. Secondly, Bonacci was diagnosed with MPD, multiple personality disorder. This is more commonly referred to as dissociative identity disorder these days. The mental health disorder is characterized by the patient experiencing at least two different personality states or personas. Now, the diagnosis is extremely rare and very controversial. In fact, many psychologists dispute whether it's even a real disorder. This is because a 1973 book written by Flora Schreiber detailed the treatment of Shirley Ardell Mason for multiple personality disorder by her psychiatrist, Dr. Cornelia Wilbur. The book was titled Sybil, because at the time of publication, the patient was given the name Sybil Dorset to maintain her anonymity. The book became the basis for many elements of the diagnosis, but was later considered to be fraudulent. But Debbie Nathan, a criminal justice journalist from the United States, fiercely debunked many aspects of the book and the disorder in a book she published in 2011. Nevertheless, the original book by Schreiber sold incredibly well in the 70s and 80s and formed a key part in the hysteria that fed into the satanic panic. Anyway, if multiple personality disorder, or DID, is a genuine phenomenon, then Paul Bonacci does happen to be a textbook case who would meet all of the hallmarks of an individual who is likely to be susceptible to be at risk of developing the mental health condition. That being severe childhood trauma from a close caregiver, both physical and sexual, childhood trafficking and significant betrayal between the ages of 2 to 6 years of age. But I'm getting sidetracked. Bonacci's lawyer, John DeCamp, contacted Noreen Ghosh, who agreed to meet with Bonacci in prison. Bonacci was unaware of who he was about to meet. Despite how upsetting it was to hear the details, Noreen said she was thankful for Paul Bonacci for coming forward and sharing this information with her. She ultimately believed that he was telling the complete truth. This was, well, because Bonacci drew Noreen a map of the Johnny Ghosh abduction site. It was carefully planned in advance, he said. The map included the streets and the exact spot from where Johnny was abducted. This was of particular interest to Noreen, because it had been widely publicized in the media as occurring in a different location to where it actually happened. But Bonacci's map identified the correct location, which was only known to Noreen and the authorities at the time. Additionally, there was a composite sketch made from Bonacci's description of Tony, and it was similar to the original sketch that had been made of Johnny's abductor. Bonacci went further into detail, admitting that he was the first one to sexually assault Johnny, and that the men in charge filmed it in order to advertise him to prospective buyers. Johnny had been tied up and gagged for most of his time. Johnny remained calm and spoke to Bonacci about meditation to block out the abuse, a skill that he had learned from his mother. Noreen said that she'd never told the press or police that Johnny had gone to yoga classes with her, as that hadn't been relevant. No one knew that Johnny practiced meditation, which she taught him, when he was stressed or overwhelmed, except Noreen. But Bonacci revealed how Johnny taught him the same skills during captivity. Further, Bonacci described a birthmark on Johnny's chest that looked like the shape of South America. Now, whilst this birthmark had been described previously in the press, Bonacci was also able to list other marks and scars that Johnny had that weren't shared with the public, such as a scar on Johnny's tongue from where he'd bitten through it as a young child, a burn scar on his lower leg from touching a hot exhaust pipe on a car, and a stammer that he had when he would get nervous or upset. She said all of that information was not public or known outside of her close family. Bonacci would claim that he had first been groomed by the sex ring back in 1978, and he was frequently brought along in the car when the ring would abduct children for their parties. Emilio was the leader of the ring, acting under payment and orders from Lawrence E. King directly. Bonacci said that to the best of his knowledge, he believed that Johnny was still alive. Following the America's Most Wanted interview, the producers of the show would share the unedited footage with Des Moines police. Bizarrely, they said that they wouldn't go and interview Paul Bonacci, that they didn't consider him a credible witness as he was a convicted criminal. Investigators would, however, go on to interview Bonacci's siblings, who each stated that they had no knowledge of what Bonacci was recalling. Lieutenant Kyle McKinney of West Des Moines Police Department said that they might interview Paul Bonacci in the future, though he continued to say that currently his view was that the information wasn't valid and the other witnesses who had come forward weren't really credible either. During a subsequent interview with Inside Edition, Noreen Gosh said that she felt like Paul Bonacci shared so much information with her that would have been outright impossible for him to know unless he'd spent time with Johnny. Bonacci stated in his America's Most Wanted interview that the men in charge of the abduction ring would take pictures of the children, who were forced to do the most awful things, and eventually use these pictures to blackmail them so that they wouldn't leave the criminal organization and so that they could be coerced and controlled, even after their use as a child victim had been aged out. Johnny, Bonacci said, had been purchased by a man that was known as, quote-unquote, the Colonel. The Colonel was from Colorado, he believed. Johnny was branded with a mark of ownership by the Colonel, an X with a curved line underneath. Soon after, more witnesses and alleged victims began calling, saying that they also have the same brands and confirmed many of Bonacci's stories. Paul Bonacci described the Colonel's house in Colorado, where many of the children had been kept. He said there was an underground chamber beneath the house. The America's Most Wanted production team took Bonacci to the house after he left prison. Bonacci was clearly emotional and visibly shaken as he walked towards the house. Then, as the television production team recorded him, Bonacci led them to an underground chamber he had previously claimed the kids were kept in, where there were wood beams with children's initials carved into them. The owner of that house was a former prison guard who had abruptly moved out just a short time before the America's Most Wanted team arrived with Bonacci, and has never been located. The West Des Moines police would never interview Paul Bonacci.
This is a guy who says he took part in a kidnapping, knows a lot about it. You've got a case that's been unsolved for 10 years. I would think you'd be kicking the doors down to want to talk to him at this point.
When the time is right, again, I will reiterate, we may well interview Paul Bonacci, but it will be when we're ready to do it.
How much more time has to go by?
I have no idea.
It seems outrageous that you haven't spoken to him.
That's your opinion.
This was Des Moines police officer Lieutenant Lyle McKinney, being ever so helpful. A grand jury investigated Bonacci's claims, however, but ultimately determined that they were baseless and called them a carefully crafted hoax. the charges were dropped and the allegations from Paul Bonacci were credited to his multiple personality disorder, and he was charged with perjury, although those charges were ultimately dropped. Fun fact, in July 1990, the lead investigator and his 8-year-old child, who had been tasked with looking into the Franklin Credit Union scandal, Bonacci's claims of the child abduction ring and Lawrence E. King's involvement and alleged crimes, would both die when their private aeroplane mysteriously exploded in mid-air after he was returning to Omaha with a briefcase of supposed evidence to implicate King and verify Bonacci's claims. After his death, several of the alleged victims who had come forward subsequently withdrew their statements, leading to the grand jury throwing the entire case out. That briefcase of evidence went missing from the crash site and has never been located. This is a textbook conspiracy. Lawrence E. King ended up serving a 15-year prison sentence for committing multi-million dollar fraud at the Franklin Credit Union. The FBI ceased investigating the child abuse and trafficking allegations, however. In 1999, Paul Bonacci eventually filed a civil lawsuit against Lawrence King, accusing him of multiple sexual assaults, holding him prisoner, and forcing him to scavenge for other children. Lawrence King didn't appear in court or contest the accusations made against him. The judge ruled in Bonacci's favor and awarded him $1 million. Lawrence E. King Jr. was released from prison in 2001 and has remained reclusive ever since. To date, he has paid less than $40 of the $1 million owed to Paul Bonacci. In 1994, a British documentary about the Franklin scandal and the child trafficking and abuse accusations was due to release on the Discovery Channel, but it was pulled just before the air date after they were threatened with multiple lawsuits from those mentioned in the film. I'll post a link in the description to where you can watch this unaired film. In 1993, the stress of the past decade would result in Noreen and John Gosch declaring bankruptcy and getting divorced. The stress of the ordeal that the Goshes had gone through in particular seemed to weigh heavily on Noreen Gosch. During Paul Bonacci's trial against Lauren King in 1999, Noreen was questioned in court. She was under oath. She was asked if she had seen or talked to her son since he had gone missing. She initially refused to answer until the judge told her she either answered the question or she would be found in contempt of court. To audible gasps in the courtroom, Noreen said that she had seen Johnny since. In 1997, Noreen was awakened by a knock at her door at around 2:30 a.m. When she opened the door, she found two men standing there. She said that she immediately knew that one of the men was Johnny. Johnny was 27 years old at the time and said that he couldn't disclose where he had been or where he was now living, as he was still in danger and he'd be killed if they knew that he was there. He told Noreen a small bit about the children being trafficked across the country and a conspiracy that went to, quote, the very top, but wouldn't give too many details. The man who was with him stood back and didn't speak. But Noreen said that Johnny seemed to look over to him for approval before speaking. They stayed for over an hour before leaving. John Gosch Sr. has stated that he's not entirely convinced that the visit ever actually happened. But why did Noreen wait 2 years to reveal this stunning news if it was true? Well, as Noreen was testifying in a civil trial, she was asked under oath, so she could not lie about it, she said.
News Channel 8.
I was asked to not tell anybody because Johnny feared for his life and mine.
Noreen Gosch says she's seen her son Johnny, and she says the missing paper boy is alive. Good evening, and thanks for joining us. I'm Aaron Hurley.
And I'm Steve Oswald. It is an amazing revelation in a bizarre story that all began back in 1982.
I did see Johnny in March of 1997. He came here very late at night.
Noreen Gosch says her missing son Johnny knocked on her apartment door without any warning almost 2 years ago. But why wait 2 years to reveal this stunning news? Well, Gosch was in Omaha on Friday testifying in the civil trial of a man named Paul Benassi. Noreen Gosch was on the stand confirming Benassi's story when the bombshell dropped.
The attorney asked me if I had had any personal contact or, in fact, had seen or talked to my son. And I was under oath, so I had to answer.
So what's happened to Johnny Gosch after all these years?
Noreen Gosch continues to fight to have her son's story heard. There are many people in the Des Moines area that think she has lost touch with reality. Some believe that no men came to her door that night, but she truly believes that she saw his son, Johnny. Unfortunately, no one can corroborate it or rule it out definitively. Noreen has remarried to a man named George Hartney and teaches yoga classes for stress management. She is very active in the community of adults with missing children. Eugene Martin's parents have both since passed away, never knowing what happened to their son. Mark Allen's mother has openly criticized the Des Moines Police Department for the handling of her son's case. The cases of Johnny Gosch, Eugene Martin, and Mark Allen remain open to this day. The abductions throughout the 1980s remain officially unrelated. Investigators have not released any new information about the paperboy's disappearances since the mid-1980s. Before we end tonight's episode, I'd like to leave you with a few points of circumstantial evidence which I have come across in my research for this episode. As I said, it's circumstantial, so it could mean nothing, though it could be relevant. I'll let you decide. After Wilbur Milhouse left his employment at the Des Moines Register as a circulation manager, he was replaced by another man in the role, another man named Emilio Mendoza. We know that there were several active child abusers at the Register during this period, Milhouse, Frank Sikora, etc. So could Emilio Mendoza be the Emilio that Paul Bonacci spoke about? Additionally, located at 1424 East Euclid Avenue, Des Moines, from 1978 to 1983, was a club named the Joker's Lounge. The building is still there today, but it's a Quick Trip now. Quick Trip is an American chain of convenience stores, by the way. Well, the Joker Lounge was owned at the time by Pete Bonacci, who is coincidentally the uncle of Paul Bonacci. Raul Anker, who was a primary suspect in the kidnapping of Eugene Martin, amongst other crimes including several murders, was a frequent patron of the Joker Lounge. The club was known to hire off-duty police officers as bouncers while it was open, including one officer named Nick Brown, who was the assistant chief of police in Des Moines. Brown's daughter was Debbie Soda. So Nick Brown was Sam Soda's father-in-law. This could be relevant because Paul Bonacci stated that after Johnny's abduction, they drove to Sioux City, but on the way they stopped at a place called the Joker's Lounge for a short time. Just some nuggets of food for thought. The unsolved Des Moines paperboy abduction cases remain a haunting reminder to the parents and community at large. There remains a disturbing number of conspiracies, secrets, and shocking truths about that period of time and the child abductions. It seems even underneath the blue Midwestern skies of Iowa, evil and perversion still run deep. Is it possible that a child predator ring was abducting children off the streets? Were the disappearances an attempt to keep certain information quiet? Or is it possible that the missing boys are still alive, either brainwashed or coerced into a life of crime, and now remain in hiding? Tune in Wednesday for our next episode. For our Patreon supporters, you'll get some new content tomorrow. Finally, and talking of Patreon, if you haven't already, please consider signing up to our exclusive Patreon for more episodes, research material, and articles. It's just $2, so a hell of a bargain for the amount of extra content that you get. A huge thank you to everyone who has already joined. You are awesome, and we couldn't do this without your guys' help and support. So thank you so much. Good night, everyone.